You could argue that one of the greatest ideas of all time is the idea of language. After all, that's how we communicate, and that's what we use to express our ideas. Nicholas Oestler would probably agree. Oestler's the author of Empires of the Word, A Language History of the World. He says that there's often a correlation between wealth and the spread of languages.
Show me the money is quite a good way of looking at it. I mean, why was it that when Latin came to the end of its dominance through the fact that learned people were not sufficient to sustain it, and this happened in the middle of the 15th to the 16th centuries, why was it that French was the language which then came out to be the most prominent international language? The only explanation that I can see is because French was the language of the strongest and certainly the richest power of Europe at the time. I think this is what you're going to see as China grows in per capita wealth. Its culture will become more and more a focus of prestige. I mean, we've already seen that happen in a small way with Japanese in the second half of the 20th century, so that people now have heard of sumo and sushi, and those Pokemon gotta-catch-em-all children's heroes are based on sumo contestants. When a country becomes a force to be reckoned with economically, one tends to see its culture becoming attractive all over the world. And with it, of course, the language will come.
One of the things that's interesting to me about all of this is that so far in all of the transitions that you've described, the inherent nature of the language itself seems virtually unimportant compared to the force of emigration, the force of capitalism, the force of military might.
Well, I think there's a limit to that. It's an interesting point. I mean, and that is the sort of dogma of linguistics, really, that it makes no difference to the fate of a language what sort of grammar or structure or propensity to borrow vocabulary that it may have. However, I think you can see that that is limited in the sense that languages spread more easily over other languages which are more similar to them. This we can see in the case of the rapid advance of Arabic across the world, out of the Arabian deserts, to the east as far as Afghanistan, and to the west as far as Spain, and right up to the Pyrenees Mountains, in the 7th century AD. That happened. Arabic got itself established all the way along there and was spoken for, I don't know, three or four generations. But the fact is that only in the center of that zone, which is a pretty large center, I may say, all the way along North Africa and in the Middle East as far as the borders of Iraq, only there did it actually stick and is it spoken to this day. And if you look at what was there before, those were all relatively closely related languages to Arabic. Where the languages were very different, whether it was Persian out to the east, or forms of Romance, which they call in the time, we now call it Spanish and Catalan and such languages, in the West, where that somehow Arabic was not so readily taken up. So I think there is a tendency, there is a certain resistance which can be seen, which prevents languages from being taken up, even when you might think they could easily be taken up.
Well, this raises the question of whether English and Chinese, for instance, have enough in common that one or the other could get dominance over the other. It hasn't so far. They seem so different from each other in the ways in which the language is spoken and written. For one to replace the other is more difficult. I guess it's then a question of whose space in between they are competing for.
Yes, I would be very unlikely to see one language or the other replace the other. But I think, you know, that as it, the people don't really point this out, but this is one of the things I thought it was quite straightforward from a linguist's point of view. Chinese and English are rather similar languages in terms of word order and structure. You know, you have the subject and then the verb and then the object. So that thinking in Chinese and thinking in English are not that different in terms of the order of elements as you have to go through them. Where they do differ, of course, is in the writing system and indeed in the phonology, the system of sounds which makes one word different from another. Now, it's certainly the case that it's difficult for English people to learn Chinese going from any sort of written version, which is likely to be the way that they're taught it. But if they were to learn Chinese orally, it seems to me, and if they were to learn it earlier enough in life, it's quite possible that, as I say, these sort of similarities that there are between English and Chinese might have a quite unexpected force. But for that to happen, I think, people have to start moving away from written language. And this may be what we're seeing in our education systems, I don't know. As people get more and more in the way of technical support, it may be that the traditional skills of literacy will loom smaller, and you may well conceivably find it easier to learn Chinese as a result of that.
Well, this actually raises another interesting question, because I assume, again, from what you've written, that many of the effects on language were due to the difficulty of getting from one place to another. Certainly in the early days, when there were far fewer people, interaction was minimal. Now, well, we're fond of saying this is becoming a very small world. Technology, transportation, it's hard to remain isolated. What effect do you think that is going to have on the domination of languages?
Well, one effect it has is that, as never in the past, it's possible to be influenced by the spoken language of a completely different part of the world from you. You can see the action on TV and you can hear the description in the language going on. You can have chat shows which are now audible in China, but are being broadcast from Burbank or from Shepherd's Bush in London. So that means that there's a channel for the spread of oral language, and possibly this might even improve people's performance in learning languages across the world, since quite often it's young people and children who are most exposed in this way. So that is a difference. But what doesn't change, I think, is the fact that people actually live in their own communities with their own friends talking to them in a language where they feel comfortable. And there's no reason to suppose that people will en masse adopt the language of wider communication for those more intimate parts of their lives, I think.
So it's a variation on the immigration theory. You come in from the outside, but unless there is a reason for the local population to want that other language, whether it's religion or commerce, they're likely to stay with their own.
Well, yes. I mean, by inertia, they will do that. If they think it's particularly cool to learn somebody else's language, then, and that this obviously from the very nature of the word cool, this tends to be a generational thing, you may find that there's a shift takes place. But when it is a matter of youth culture, as people have often appealed, then, you know, people only stay young for a certain amount of time, and then they tend to switch back again. People made this point about Japanese culture a lot, that the old-style arts never seem to die away, although they're never popular with the young. People always come back to them later in life. Yeah. Now, of course, if you lose a language too thoroughly, you're not going to be able to come back to it.
Looking at the world today, of course, it's difficult to try to reason out what's going to happen, because these kind of changes take place over long periods of time. You don't establish the dominance of one language over another in the course of a decade or even...
Or even one generation.
Yeah. But looking at it now, you look back at what happened with English in India, for instance, and the importance of religion there. Looking at the world today, do you see forces that are more likely to push change than others?
Well, what's happening? I mean, communications are an important thing. And it is possible now to follow from anywhere in the world what's going on in the world as a whole. And you're likely to get your information through one or more of the languages of wider communication. Most likely, you will get that through English. But what we are seeing also is that areas of the world which in the 19th and early 20th centuries were areas for exploitation from the West are beginning to assert themselves on their own terms. And this is particularly happening in various parts of Asia. But we're also seeing it, I suppose, in South America, particularly in a place like Brazil. Now, that self-assertion by the other parts of the world, the fact that people are catching up in a way and maybe taking over in different parts of the world, is going to have a linguistic consequence. I mean, we've already seen the early effects of self-assertion by the Arab nations, this is not working out too well at the moment. But I think this is going to be a global phenomenon that we see, and often fueled much more by flexing of a sense of greater independent power than by senses of resentment. So I think it's a very challenging and interesting period that we confront, and we shall see languages like Hindi Urdu from India, and indeed Arabic, growing in importance, I'm confident, over the next 50 years.
Nicholas Oestler is the author of Empires of the Word, A Language History of the World.